Today's episode of the Film Stage Show is brought to you by MUBI, the online streaming cinema. For your free 30-day trial, go to mubi.com/filmstage.
One Friday night I took a pill or maybe two. Down at the car park I saw everyone I knew. And before the night we started, we had plenty of pressure party. Just a place that someone knew. Look who I've belonging to, a gangster's crew.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the movie review podcast from filmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today we have Michael Snydell.
Hello.
Hello. We also have Bill Graham.
Woo!
Yeah. And you are listening to Jake Bugg's Seen It All, a song about one crazy night in the life of a young man. And we have that playing because today we're going to be talking about the film Good Time from the Softy Brothers. Another movie about a crazy life, crazy night in the life of a young man. Before that, Michael will be giving us a brief review of The Glass Castle, the newest film from director of Short Term 12. And, that's about it. That's all we really got planned for you today. So hopefully you enjoy all this. Before we get into that, though, let's do the usual housekeeping stuff. We can be found on Twitter. Bill Graham, do you want to tell the people where you can find on Twitter?
Find us on Twitter?
Yeah.
Sure. You can find us at The Film Stage Show.
Nope,
or isn't it just Film Stage Show?
You yep,
because
the test.
The Film Stage Show has too many letters. I remember that.
Yes.
But make sure you don't go. Make sure you do go to thefilmstageshow.com, because if you go to Film Stage Show, that's not the website.
No, it's not. And if you're searching for us on Facebook, it is The Film Stage Show.
Yes, very right. Confusing. Good
you
job.
Were close. I just decided. I was like, I wonder if anyone even knows what our Twitter handle is, and I was right. We did not.
That we do not. Oh, come on.
Well, you notoriously are not big on Twitter, so.
Or facts.
Or facts. That's true. I'm looking forward to the moment when we have to explain both the names of The Glass Castle and Good Time to Bill. Also, you can email us.
Good Time might be a little harder, honestly.
We could you can email us podcast@thefilmstage.com and find us on iTunes, give us a comment and a rating. Also, you can find us on Patreon, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. We do use the definite article there. And by giving us some money, as little as $1 every episode, you get access to the special Slack channel where we talk with our listeners. You will also be put in for raffles that happen about once a week, and you'll help us create cool new shit. So go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow to help us out that way. And now we want to help you out by telling you about MUBI, the online streaming cinema where their curators collect and release awesome films. A new film every day that you have 30 days to watch, so you constantly have a rotating selection of 30 films. And this is pretty awesome, because the other week we were talking about Eraserhead, and we found out that apparently Bill Graham hasn't seen shit from David Lynch. I'm still trying to get over.
Same.
Now, so have you seen it yet, Bill? Did you watch it?
I have not had time. Saturday was a clusterfuck. So.
You got 30 days. You got 30 days
I do. I do indeed. Cool thing is I could definitely take that with me. I could download it onto my phone after downloading like 20,000 apps or deleting 20,000 apps. But I am not going to watch that movie on my phone because it deserves to be on a big screen.
Yes, I would actually love I would love to just get on the subway and just watch Mulholland Drive going just to see what that is like. MUBI. Check it out. You can go to mubi.com/filmstage and you can get a free 30-day trial on us so that you too can understand the wonder that is MUBI. Again, that's mubi.com/filmstage. All right, Michael Snydell.
Wait, a little bit of an audible here. There was a there was kind of some sad news this morning. I don't know if you did you guys see who passed this morning?
I know that my uncle passed away last night, so I'm assuming we're not talking about that.
Sorry for your loss. Jesus.
Yeah.
Way to just hijack another person's loss, Brian.
Well, I mean, anyway. You know me. I need to be the center of attention. So, were you not talking about? Were you not talking about my Uncle Vinny?
No.
No, I wasn't. Noted horror director Tobe Hooper, Toby Hooper.
Tobe?
Sorry. Died last night. So he's a director who's, you know, he's known for Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And though there's some controversy about his involvement in Poltergeist, like that's another big one he's involved with. But he had a pretty long and pretty interesting career. So, and Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a fucking masterpiece. So,
Crazies too.
No, I think that was actually
The Crazies?
Raven, yeah. Maybe?
Yeah, that was someone else. I remember that film. Yeah.
But he did Funhouse. He did Life Force. He did he's done a lot of different stuff and had and I'm really looking forward to I'm going to finally see the Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 on 35. It's playing in Chicago next month, so I'm pretty excited to check that out. But I just thought we should briefly mention that because he's a director that I think, you know, like as far as like his larger work, I feel like it gets talked about a little less. But if anything, he certainly made a mark with Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So before your audible was called, you were going to tell us about the Glass Castle.
Oh, great. I get to talk more.
Yes, you do.
So.
I know how much you love being put off the leash and allowed to do whatever you want.
So it's
the thing that scares you most in this world.
So I came home to the suburbs. I have the strange experience where I hear nature and I'm very confused because I'm used to hearing either construction or traffic. But while I was in the suburbs, my mom wanted to see a movie. So she had read The Glass Castle, which is the Jeanette Walls memoir from, in the last decade, I think it came out. But I was especially interested in it because it's actually the follow-up, as Brian said at the beginning, to Daniel Dustin Cretton's 2013 film Short Term 12, which was kind of I really like that film, but it's retroactively kind of an interesting coming out party for Brie Larson and Lakeith Stanfield as two really meteoric actors. And so Short Term 12 was a film of kind of grand gestures. Like, have either of you guys seen Short Term 12? I can't remember.
Yes, I loved it.
To my shame, okay. I have not.
Okay. To give a brief synopsis, Short Term 12 is about a kind of group home where a group of kids who are dealing with all kinds of substance abuse and various things. It's about the relationship between the counselors and the kids. And it's a very kind of small, very intimate film. And so it's interesting that he then tackled Glass Castle, which is Jeanette Walls' memoir that bears more than a slight resemblance to last year's Captain Fantastic. It's about a family that kind of lives hand to mouth and is just kind of vagabonds across the country because the father is an alcoholic and can't hold a job. And it's at first kind of represented as like this adventure, but the film doesn't really work, but I wanted to briefly talk about it because it's pretty interesting in the sense that for a long time, it has some things to say about how bullying parenting is seen as like enlightenment. Like it comments on that in some interesting ways in the sense that Woody Harrelson, who plays the father, is not only this alcoholic, but he's this person who believes in this very experience first type of parenting. Like that's most bluntly shown in a scene where his young daughter is clutching onto the side of a pool and she can't swim. And he decides to teach her how to swim to throw her over and over into the pool and have her fend for herself. So there's a lot of that type of parenting in this, in him trying to show his kids to live their life by being totally independent. It again stars Brie Larson, who was also in Short Term 12. And she's very good, but it's weird to see a movie that one needs to rely on a flashback structure. Like, if you're going to tell the story of this woman's life, it becomes this strange thing of, rather than focusing on this really interesting family, it becomes this whole flashback structure where Brie Larson looks back on her life and all of the good and bad lessons she learned. But I think what is the most strange thing about this is that in the second and third act, it gets really, really grim. And then right at the end, literally 5 minutes after something horrific happens, it pulls back and comes back to a Hollywood ending. So it's just this strange thing where this movie that needs some grit, you know, maybe something even like Good Time, keeps going back to these very Hollywood gestures. So I'm not totally put off from Cretton as a filmmaker, but I'm a little worried that he doesn't know how to rein in, you know, these like life-affirming moments without undercutting his own story. So, yeah, I wouldn't super recommend it. I mean, it's kind of an interesting case study in how weird it is. But I just thought I should mention it, because I know Short Term 12 is beloved for a lot of people. So,
yes,
that's my movie minute.
All right. I remember seeing commercials or trailers for this and thinking, oh good, so it's like Captain Fantastic, except the movie knows he's an asshole.
I mean, the movie kind of does know that. That's what's so strange about it, and then it pulls back.
Ugh, I hate that.
Yeah,
that's like legitimately child abuse, and I'm not cool with movies
for sure
that like laud
glamorize it.
So that's why I never bothered to see Captain Fantastic, because I was like, I just from the tone of the trailer, I was like, I know this is going to disturb me.
Other than Boo, that's the worst movie I saw last year.
Wait,
I completely stand
Boo
by
this year.
No, I know, but that
oh,
came
but it
out.
It was
last
a 2016 release.
Yeah,
I see. I see what you mean. Okay, so that's that. Now we can.
Wait, I'd like to put in a plug. If you really hated Captain Fantastic, I would highly recommend Scout Tafoya's review at Brooklyn Magazine. He wrote a pan of it that is fantastic.
I cannot wait to read that. all right, let's talk about the movie that we all saw now.
Sorry.
It's fine. And that is Good Time, the newest film from Benny and Josh Safdie. And this stars Robert Pattinson. So here is the trailer.
Incredible, do you understand?
Yeah.
I'm serious. You think I could have done that without you standing next to me being strong? Are you feeling this? Are you feeling good as I'm feeling right now?
Yeah, I'm cold.
You cold?
Yeah.
Let's get to Virginia, man.
Just keep your head down.
Turn around. He's all right. We didn't
do it. Whoa, whoa, get back here. Turn around. Under arrest.
So I told you about my brother, yeah? Something happened. I don't know exactly what. He's been arrested. He's being held at Rikers Island.
Love? Oh my God, that's awful.
Make me queen.
Just gotta get him out of there before something bad happens. He could get killed in there.
The pure is out from love. Damned always out.
You need another 10 grand. You get another 10 grand, your brother will get out.
The truth is out.
All right, so that is the trailer for Good Time. And a movie with a deceptively simple premise. Robert Pattinson plays Connie Nikas, who robs a bank with his brother Nicholas Nikas, and unfortunately his brother, who is developmentally disabled, is caught by the police. Now, Robert Pattinson's trying to get him out of prison because he is sure that he will not do well locked up in Rikers Island for any amount of time. Unfortunately, a dye pack exploded, and so he is still $10,000 short of being able to make bail. And this is the story of one night of him trying to get that money. There's a lot of twists and turns. Let's talk about it. I assume that the spoiler section might be larger than the review section. So let's give our basic thoughts on Good Time, and then we can get into talking about the plot more. So, Bill Graham, you haven't had too much of a chance to speak yet. What were your thoughts on Good Time?
Well, Michael, were you trying to say something real quick?
Yeah, I was just wondering what you guys want to consider spoilers.
Everything after the hospital.
Okay. So yeah. Not before the hospital.
No, before the hospital, I think we're in safe territory.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
That's all I wanted to say.
Okay.
Spoiler
alert, there's a hospital. All right.
So I had first run into the Safdies. I believe it was at South by Southwest for Heaven Knows What. Heaven Knows What? Is that what it
is?
Yes. Okay.
Heaven Can Wait.
Facts. No, not Heaven Can Wait.
Just like Heaven.
The false.
Different movie.
False. Another false. And I really enjoyed the chat with them. One thing that's interesting is they keep utilizing a lot of the same people. A lot of familiar faces kind of pop up in this film that I was like, oh, I recognize that person. And then I realized, no, I don't really recognize that person from anything else except Heaven Knows What. I was like, ah, okay, interesting. So they have a very interesting filming style. This film certainly bears that out. It reminds me a little bit of kind of the frenetic energy of Michael Mann a bit. I'm trying to think how I felt about this film overall. It's a tough, winding film. And so at times I was frustrated with it. At times I was into it. At times I just didn't know where it was going. And it's got kind of a propulsive energy that stops and starts and stops and starts. And that's mainly because of the way that these characters are drawn and kind of their life. Robert Pattinson is, I think, really, really good in this film. He's kind of disgusting and kind of just all over the place. And he gets his brother into a lot of shit that probably shouldn't be getting into. And I'm not sure if there's a lot of love there outside of just him being his brother or if it's something more. But it is interesting to see kind of the relationship between Connie and Nick. And as this film just kind of barrels along, it starts to kind of really become a frustrating kind of practice of watching these characters just kind of grind and grind and grind. I'm not sure how y'all felt about kind of the way that this ends, and certainly I don't want to get into that quite yet, but it'll be interesting to get into spoilers when we start to kind of really delve into this film, because it's tough to encapsulate everything that – hold on. I'm about to sneeze. Ooh, okay, that passed. It's tough to encapsulate kind of everything that happens in this film and really kind of delve into, you know, the nits that I want to pick with it. But overall, I think this is really interesting and just kind of dynamic experience. And I'm not sure if this is necessarily built for everybody. It's certainly – well, I take that back. It's definitely not built for everybody. These characters in particular are just kind of down and out characters. I love that Connie's kind of attitude is that he's kind of above a lot of all of this stuff. And yet he's kind of the one that's creating a lot of the chaos that he's kind of railing against at times. And so, yeah, I think this is a really dynamic film from two young filmmakers that are just kind of now hitting their mark. It's like really well shot too. There's some like helicopter shots, or I guess it might be drone footage. I'm not sure. That I was struck by how much money this film probably cost compared to heaven knows what. And they've done some interesting stuff with long perspectives where they set up a camera really far away and just zoom in on the characters, and then they don't have to shut off streets. They don't have to do anything like that. They can just film on the streets and utilize that. So it's interesting their filmmaking style and their kind of mentality with it. So,
all right, Michael Snydell.
Yeah. Stop me if you've heard this one, guys, but I kind of love this. I finally caught up with Heaven Knows What earlier this week, and it was really interesting to finally see the Safdies. I'd kind of, you know, heard about them vaguely, you know, being lumped in with a lot of New York directors, whether you're talking about like John Majory or Alex Ross Perry or any of these kind of
hiss.
I'd heard them talked about within that, but I guess the key thing that a lot of people pointed out is that they're far more interested in class and the way that class is in plain sight, in the sense of heaven knows what partly made it so powerful for me is that so many of these arguments between, you know, drug addicts and things like that are happening in broad daylight in heavily crowded streets. So there's constantly a sense that there are two worlds that you're looking at any given sense, or excuse me, at any given moment. And I think, Good Time takes that even further by being a great thriller, but also an even more interesting view into modern New York and the way, again, that class is layered on top of each other. And the sense of, you know, you have two characters who are coming at the world in two really interesting ways. You have Connie, played by Robert Pattinson, who's kind of this polite monster. And then you have Nick, played by one of the directors, Benny Safdie. And so Connie sees everyone as targets and as a person he can take advantage of. And Nick thinks everyone sees him as a target. And I think that duality there makes this an incredibly interesting film. I mean, the optics of this are so carefully planned out in terms of just from even the first moment, they literally disguise themselves. I want to say it's maybe a Morpheus mask. Either way, though, they are masking themselves as black characters. And the whole movie is about that masking, how they can just, especially Robert Pattinson's character, can just be a sycophant, but because he, especially with Robert Pattinson, because he slightly has this dreamboat quality, he's able to get away with nearly everything. So it's such an interesting reversal on so many of these you know, getaway movies we've seen, because, you know, even pointing at something like Michael Mann, how they're always like one step ahead of the cops. They're not really one step ahead of the cops in this. They're always getting out of things by the skin of their teeth, but just as likely they are using anyone in their vicinity. But what I really like about this is the rare movie that is about manipulation that doesn't actually feel mean-spirited as well. Like, like at a certain point, this almost becomes an examination of like inherent decency and like how kind people can be and how they trust people. Like so even taking away like the racial aspects in terms of, sorry, I almost got into spoilers there. But the point being, so not only is it incredibly interesting on that level, but as a thriller, it's just, it's great. Bill didn't mention OPN, 10 Trix Point Never soundtrack yet, which is just, it's terrifying. It is a panic attack for the whole movie. And it's really interesting and abrasive and just inescapable in the same way that Sean Price Williams, the cinematographer, slowly takes something that feels totally mundane. Like it even comes in the lighting, like in the early part of the movie where it's just kind of office lighting, and slowly it just becomes this carnival funhouse as the lights just kind of mix together and become this strange kaleidoscope. But it doesn't become a dream. Like they're always like totally lucid. That's what I like about so much about this movie is like there's a constantly a danger. It's not a sense that that like these characters can get away scot-free or that they'll just open their eyes. Like at any moment something terrible could happen. And so it's that combination of the danger and just the electricity in the filmmaking, and then that really interesting like meta exploration of Connie's views of institutions and individuals, which I think comes in the bookends, which I know some people don't like, but I definitely like to talk about them. But yeah, this is one of my favorite movies of the year at this point.
Agreed. This is
what?
This is an incredible movie. First of all, I'll continue to heap praise on Robert Pattinson.
I do want to fight back against the Dreamboat quality, because yes, typically he has that. In this film, he looks like trash.
Okay, like, no, but he looks like a trashy Dreamboat. I was just about to say that. I grew up with a lot of shitty friends. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So like he gets away with things because he's just a little bit more attractive.
Yeah, like I had a bunch of friends who were like dirtbags, like shitty, fucked up dirtbags who would destroy a human life if it would get them something that they wanted for like 5 minutes. And they all looked like Robert Pattinson looks in this movie, which is... Maybe if you cleaned up a bit and, like, stopped cursing so much, you would be a respectable, like, presentable person. But instead, like, they sort of almost seem to, like, lean in to like, how rotten their soul is. So they use that as an excuse to, like, just not shower and constantly smell like cigarettes. And so, like, yeah, I found it a very authentic portrayal of a truly horrible human being. And... like, we've been talking about him for a while. Like, I've The Rover.
Cosmopolis.
I didn't like stars. Cosmopolis, but I like him in Cosmopolis. And then, what else was there? The Lost Maps City of the Z. The Life of a... The Childhood of a Leader.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like, he's been on fire recently. So when I say that this is probably his best performance, you'll understand the weight that I give that. Because I just named movies... yeah. That have almost consistently been in my top 10 of the year. So yeah,
he disappears.
He's nuts in this movie in the best way possible. And the movie is so good at being that horrifying like stress dream that you have where nothing goes right. And you're constantly
it almost keeps going right, and so you keep trying, you never give up. It's kind of that grasping for straws kind of thing where you're just like, yeah, but if just one thing just falls in the right way, this whole night is over. Like this whole night is everything works, you know.
That's the thing. He could cut and run at any time and probably be okay-ish.
Mm-hmm.
At least not as bad as he is, but he keeps getting so close that rather than cut and run and just be happy that he's still alive, he's constantly like, okay, but I'm going to mortgage this failure and I'm going to, I'm going to compound the possibility of the next failure being even worse. And it's like, it's crazy. The cinematography is fantastic. Sean Price Williams, I believe, is the cinematographer for this. And it is, we've already thrown out Michael Mann's name. There were definitely moments in this where I was like, ooh, this is like a dirty white trash Collateral. Mm-hmm. And it feels that way in like the best way. In fact, when I was in the movie theater, I was like, this is like Collateral, but if Jamie Foxx was a real piece of shit. Like, if you half didn't want him to get away from Vincent.
Well, I want to know, Brian, sorry, I just want to mention this real quick. The one really random one I didn't expect is this is like a like neon-streaked, talented Mr. Ripley. That's what this especially reminded me of.
That's a good one. I like that. It's true, because he steals identities, he steals, like, stories from people, and... Mm-hmm. It's funny that so we talked about The Bad Batch and how in that movie it seemed that a lot of the worst fates were resigned to characters of color.
Sure.
And we were talking about like whether that was a statement or did it mean anything. And in this movie it is like that, but it is 100% a statement. Like, you can feel the intention behind it.
Mm-hmm.
In this crappy, shitty white guy who's just destroying the lives of everyone around him, and they almost uniformly are people of color, and it's crazy. And you can look at this movie through that lens of like, what does this say about like white male fears of institutions and like how race can even overcome class in terms of who you think should be a victim. And you can also just look at it as this is a crazy fucking movie with a lot of shit going on, and it's propulsive and nuts. And in the way that like it will give time for people to give like a monologue about a day in their life and show every minute of it. It sometimes reaches like a kind of gritty Queens-based Guy Ritchie, but like good early Guy Ritchie, not present day, not so great Guy Ritchie. And it's just kind of thrilling to watch. Like, from the moment it starts, you got this kind of like claustrophobic close up. And then the further out into the city they get and the more stuff that happens, like, you would feel like you'd have some time to breathe and maybe open up, but, like, it never does that. And it becomes a study in stress and anxiety. And there were times when, like, my mouth was literally on the floor. Like, why would you do that to a person? Or who would think to do that?
One thing that's really interesting is, can you imagine spending, like, any amount of time with Connie in this film? Like it would just be a constant go, 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 go. And I'm not talking about just in like the movie's like reality of like what happens in this kind of like day long like craziness. I'm just talking about like in general. Like, when he gets his brother out of that place, like immediately they are moving, and it never stops from beginning to end. And I just imagine being around him and just being so tired. Like, just like, oh my god, will you please stop and just like settle down for half a, like, I imagine Connie gets like 2 hours of sleep.
Yeah. And it's, yeah, it's funny because to the best of my knowledge, I don't remember seeing him doing any drugs in this movie. So this is just
Well, and he mentions at one point that weed doesn't like it doesn't
do anything to him. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was
you're just like, what? Okay.
I was deeply concerned because like there are many surface aspects of this character that are very similar to me.
Mm-hmm.
One is the fact that we are immune.
Do you have a brother?
I do have a brother. He is not developmentally disabled.
Okay.
But like, so he's like, he said that he was immune to weed, and I was like, oh shit, so am I. And then he talks about dogs had, like, loving him and how he thinks he was a dog in a past life. And I was like, fuck, I have said that to people. So I know that a THC immunity and an affinity for dogs is like a light connection to be worried about. But at the same time, this is not a character you want to feel close to in any way. So. Yeah. And and this movie also takes place primarily, you know, for the most part in Queens. And so my grandmother and grandfather lived in Queens. Well, live in Queens. My grandmother lives in Queens. And so, like, when he is wandering around and, like, goes into someone's house, like, I have been around those houses. I have seen that weird vacuum-formed light-up Santa Claus head hanging off of a neighbor's house. And it was deeply distressing to see a place that I, like, in my mind, connect with my grandmother and, like, really good chicken cutlets. To be seen this way, and it was crazy. It was nuts.
Well, I think Brian, like, one other really interesting side point for that is that, like, there's a real sense of geography and distance in this movie. Like, not only does it seem like I have not been in New York, but I get the sense that this is very authentic, but just the fact that, for instance, they're on a bus for a long time, and, like, just you get this sense that they're going block after block, and how everything is so far spread apart, and, like, the tension that also comes from that.
Absolutely. And it's funny that when the bus is, like, stopping somewhere, like, there it's double parking, and it's double parking behind another, like, truck that's double parked. There's just so much about this movie that speaks to me about all of my experiences in Queens, and it's really crazy. Like, it's, and I know that it's the type of thing that for me, it created, like, a deeper connection to the story and, like, gave it another dimension. But I also think it's just a sign of care on the part of the filmmakers that there's so much truth and verisimilitude to the world surrounding what is ostensibly the craziest night of this person's life, hopefully. and it really does capture that sensation of, like, you've been up just a little too long and you are in the middle of something, and so there's just no slowing down and no stopping until you fix this. I have done this, not obviously these exact things, but I have been in that situation to a degree. Like, if this is a 100, maybe I've been at, like, a 40. And so to see it play out, to see, like, those, like, you know, moments where you're in the car and you're driving and then you get out and you're like, oh my god, is this over yet? No, we still have to do this other thing. Okay, well, someone can go get fast food and we're just gonna have a conversation. And to feel like there's just, like, this constant momentum forward, but you just don't know when it's going to end, is it was, like, awesome to see on screen. Like, this is a movie that works on many levels, and I think its most visceral one is the fever dream recreation of a night where nothing goes right for a very long time. So, yeah. Oh, also the score is fantastic.
I have to say, I know we all liked it to different degrees, but we're probably making this sound a lot more approachable than it is.
I think it's a really approachable movie, but then again, I'm crazy, so I don't know. Like, here's the thing. I almost called him Ryan Gosling. Robert Pattinson, I mean, that's another thing, is it feels a little like Drive in its neon-soaked, like, kind of disenfranchised aura.
Also, Hype Williams.
What was that?
Hype Williams, like Belly, especially.
Yeah. But so Robert Pattinson in this, like, he's not a good guy. And for most of the movie, you're going to be like, why are you doing these things, you terrible person? And so in that way, I think it is, like, it's approachable insofar as this is not a Terrence Malick film. You're not going to have to put up with long stretches of nothing happening. There is a constantly thrumming sense of stress and anxiety. Now, the way it's shot with its jittery close-up camera, and there's a lot of digital noise because it seems to have been filmed at night, with natural light. I guess that could be alienating to people. I think him being as much of an asshole as he is could be alienating to people. It's funny how you could very easily see this being... I think if this movie had the soul of something like Captain Fantastic, you would think that he was the hero because he's just trying to get his developmentally disabled brother out of the city into Virginia where they can, like, have a rabbit farm and he gets to feed the rabbits, George. But, like, this movie oddly very clearly comes down on the side of, like, we have these institutions and they're there to help and maybe you should avail yourself of them.
Maybe. I think even that's a little ambiguous.
It's ambiguous, but I think if you had to choose movie sides with
Fine,
Connie,
Brian, and make me choose.
I'm gonna give you a binary and you gotta pick one. So do we have any final thoughts before we get into the plot of this so we can talk about perhaps the twists and turns that we liked and maybe talk a little further about what we talked about regarding the exploitation of people of color by this white asshole?
Jennifer Jason Leigh is really good in very small role, as is Barkhad Abdi in an even smaller role. Like both
I'm the captain now. Yeah. I just want to mention one thing, and it kind of goes back to I think Michael's reservations about us making this sound like too much of a super accessible movie. I think that this is an accessible movie if you are okay spending time with some true pieces of shit. If you're okay with that, go for it. If you're not okay with that, if you're not okay with spending an hour and a half in that kind of bubble, then you may not be made to or built to watch this movie.
Yeah,
right? So
that's one of the reasons, Bill, that like I kind of likened it to an early Guy Ritchie film, because like those characters by and large were pieces of shit, but also they were like charming and funny. So if you like strip the charm and the humor away from them, you'll have one of these, this Robert Pattinson character, which again, it cannot be understated how much his acting carries this performance through, because I could see a lesser actor making this character fucking insufferable.
Agreed.
Just
a James McAvoy.
Like James McAvoy in Filth is
Someone was mentioning the other day, and I thought it was hilarious. They were talking about what kind of McAvoy performance you were going to get, and they said it was based on whether his hair was shaved or not, and that basically if his head was shaved, you were in for some fucked up shit.
Professor X is real fucked up.
Well, yeah, I guess that's the only catch. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
That movie is real fucked up, though. So, you know, whatever.
Or X-Men.
No, X-Men Apocalypse. Holy shit, what a piece of trash. Dumpster fire. Smells bad from here.
I just want to see that Holocaust scene. That's what I want to see.
Oh, Jesus.
Oh my God.
that's just what the world needs today.
Hey, man, God. If these liberals get their way, it won't be long before we tear down Auschwitz. Am I right?
Jesus.
Am I right?
You're
not.
Let's move on swiftly into spoilers for Good Time. So, how fucking crazy is it that he breaks the wrong guy out of the hospital?
I swear to you.
Oh my God.
While that was developing, I was looking at him and I was like, no, that's his brother. And then I kept looking at him and being like,
sure.
What the fuck is going on in this movie? Because I recognize the guy. And I didn't realize I recognized the guy because he's one of the main actors in Heaven Knows What. And I don't know if y'all know the history of Heaven Knows What, but Heaven Knows What does not star a bunch of actors besides Caleb Landry Jones. Caleb Landry Jones looks like a real piece of shit in that movie. He kind of looks like a real piece of shit in like everything, but he looks like a real piece of shit in that. Yeah, I know. But like... So that film took a lot of people basically off the street. They fell in love with Ariel Williams, I believe is her name.
Holmes.
And, huh?
Holmes.
Holmes, Ariel Holmes, and they fell in love with kind of her ideas and her mentality of kind of living on the streets and being homeless. And so they took her, they took her kind of pseudo boyfriend, and they took a couple of other people from her real life and told them to be movie stars. And that's the guy that shows up as Ray in this movie is one of those guys again. And I was just like, why do I recognize this guy then? I don't understand why I recognize him if he's not the brother. And I was like, this is really blowing my mind right now. And I kept looking at him and I was just like, I don't understand what's going on in this movie. And then about 5 minutes in, I was like, no, he's definitely talking without like an act or without like kind of like it didn't sound like he had cotton balls in his mouth or right. anything like that. So I was just like, wow, this is really not the right person. I was like, that is crazy. What a fucking
I thought at
crazy.
First it was just that his brother was like confused and yes! scared. And instead you slowly it took me a minute to be like, oh fuck, are you serious?
Yeah.
They got the same nose. It's crazy.
Yes. Yes. They did a really good job of because of the natural use of natural lighting throughout this film, like you never like see a full on shot of his face until like close to the end of the movie. And so like all this movie, like Michael was saying, kind of takes place over the course of kind of like one crazy ass night. Right? I think it was actually you, Brian, that was mentioning that. And like, so yeah, you never see these characters full on. You're just like, what a crazy, crazy thing to happen, because they do such a good lead up because you know the brother just got the shit kicked out of him. Yeah. And so when you see his face, this Ray's face, you're like, oh yeah, like of course he's all fucked up.
Also,
and then you're
they have what? Vaguely similar facial features. Like
yes.
he's got like a
yes.
prominent nose.
Swollen.
Yeah.
Yes, swollen features, yes.
Yeah.
And wow. Yeah, so that was crazy. I like that was the moment when I was like, what the fuck is happening in this movie in like the best way possible? Because that is exactly the type of shit that will happen to you. Is
sure.
You're like, it's fine. I've finally got everything I need. I picked up the package and I can go home. And then you open the package and there's like a 7 foot long cobra in it. And you're like, uh-oh, here we go again.
Yes.
And the 7 foot cobra in this movie is played by Buddy Duress. He plays Ray. And he... this is another thing, like, I figured that it would be like, okay, now get out, and now I gotta go get my brother again. But instead, like, they hang out.
Yeah,
and
the rest of the movie.
He's...
Well, because in some
fantastic,
way...
He might be a little more of a dirtbag than Robert Pattinson's character.
Oh yeah.
He's been in jail 8 times in real life.
He has?
Yeah.
Oh my god.
I just looked up his name.
Like I said, that guy's definitely pulled from the streets. Like, there's no doubt about it.
His fucking like monologue about what happened to him right after getting out of jail.
Oh my god.
I lived a life that was close to this for a while, where it was like I would just like go on a bender, and then I'd wake up from the bender and just like hop on to the next bender. And
you might need to watch Heaven Knows What, Brian.
Yeah.
I want to. Yeah. I want it bad. I'm probably going to do that today. Because, like, when he's talking about, like, you know, I get out of jail, and then they throw me off right in front of a liquor store. So, like, what am I going to do? So I go in. I'm already on a brandy. I call up my friend Khalif. And then he's just like, and then we go to the arcade, and, you know, we're handing out ass, and we're making sales. And then some guy runs in. He's like, guys, look, I robbed a fucking Radio Shack. And I was like, I have heard people give this monologue before. I have been a part of someone recounting this monologue before, and it's crazy, and I loved every fucking second of it, especially because when they run out of the arcade, you realize it's still broad daylight, and so this entire story that he's told has happened over the course of like maybe 4 hours because the sun is still up.
I think there's something, I think one thing too is like, I love those manic moments you're talking about, Brian, but like, even another thing that symbolizes the other half of this movie is the scene right before that, when he is sneaking into an adjacent hospital room, and there is a older woman in the bed, and he goes up to her and like gives her a little bit of orange juice, and it's like this gesture that like. It's side by side, all of that crazy crime stuff, but there's just constantly this really like lovely sense of like humanity to this.
Yeah, like, yeah. I'm trying to remember. There's this famous TV show called Leave It to Beaver, and it's got a character in it that Eddie or something like that. I can't remember the name of the character, but like he will look parents and like, you know, his friends' parents in the face and be like the sweet, charming, like so nice. And like, you really like the parents were like, yeah, that's a really good kid. And as soon as he's alone with like you, he's like, okay, how much trouble can we get into? You know, like let's go.
How much money do you have?
Yeah, Eddie Haskell is who you're saying.
Yes.
Up.
Eddie Haskell. I had a friend growing up in middle school and into high school that was literally this kid because
everyone does.
Yeah, my dad was telling me about this. Like my dad was like, "Yeah, no, I know who this kid is. You need to stop hanging out with him because he's just going to get you into a lot of trouble, and he's going to be able to sweet talk his way out of it, and you're sure. not." And I was like,
"You're not.
That's
friend,
a good
you're
point."
A mark.
Yeah, and I was like, that's a good point. I probably do need to stop hanging out with him.
And they don't give a fuck when they ruin things.
No, they don't. You get them, and it's like they come over, and they're like, "Hi, Mr. and Mrs. Snydell." Like, "Oh, I'm great. My mom says hi, by the way. Oh, that smells good, that dinner you're cooking. I wish I could stay, but blah, blah, blah." And then your mom leaves the room, and it's like, "All right, so this is what we got to do. We got to get some kitchen knives. We're going to go fucking rob the Wawa." And it's like...
She's like, "What? No, can we not do that?" And he's like, "No, this is what we're doing today. I've had it all planned out." He's just like, "Oh, Jesus."
He pulls out
like
a little like map made of crayons. And he's just like, "See, here's the entrances. We walk in the entrance, we rob it, and we walk out." And it's like, you had to draw a map for that? Yeah. Anyway.
And this film kind of starts that way with the way that he interacts with the teller. Right.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a gun. And he's just like politely robbing this place. And you're just like, what is going on right now? I guess if a teller receives that note, they're probably just going to be like, you know, insurance is going to cover this.
Yeah.
It's not worth having this kind of blow up. And of course she gives him a fucking dye pack because of course she does.
Well,
like, you dumbass.
That's the hilarious thing is she's like, she basically gives him an out too, because she gives him all the money she has in her drawer and says, "That's all I have. It's policy."
Exactly.
And he's like, "No, you go back in the vault and get more." And I was like, "Okay, buddy, if you've seen 999, you know that,
yep.
You know that the money in the vault is the one that they have with the dye packs. They leave it out for people just like you."
Yep.
And so, like, the entire time they were in that car, I was, like, waiting for it. I was, like, waiting for the die pack moment, and it happened, and it's great. I found out that I have a new thing I love in movies. It's whenever a die pack explodes in a car with the windows up, and they crash into another car.
A.K.A. 999.
Between this and 999, I've found my new thing that I love.
I will give 999 that sequence. That is a hell of a poster moment, man. That's in the trailer. It's in a poster. Like, you just see them, and there's all this red haze around, and you're just like, what the fuck is going on in this movie? Die pack, man.
Die pack.
This is a trap. You're trying to get me to say something good about 999. I know
I just said something good about 999. So, yeah. He already won me over there. Damn it.
I'm just going to win you over on that movie minute by minute. Give me another 7 years.
Oh, God.
Shot like a punk.
God damn it. Anyway.
Okay.
Yes.
I do think there is one moment I want to talk about, which I think I'm okay with. I'd like to hear your thoughts. I think the moment where they beat up Farkad Abdi, I think that works. I think the gratuitousness is absolutely part of the point. I don't know how I feel about the almost rape. I understand the point of it.
He doesn't.
No, I'm sorry. I'm talking about the young girl played. I'm sorry, guys. I should have.
Jesus. Dude.
No, so I'm saying the Farkad Abdi, there are two parts I've heard some people say is too much. One is when Farkad Abdi gets beaten to a pulp, and the other is the almost rape of the young girl whose home they stay in for a little bit when he seduces her when his mugshot shows up on the screen.
I guess we have to be careful about what we say here. You mean almost rape in that it's statutory rape, not an actual rape, right?
Fine, statutory rape.
I'm gonna throw this out there. Any manner of rape is an actual rape.
Sure. Okay.
I'm going to say that yes. It's not a rape. It would not be considered a rape that involves violence.
Yes.
Though it does exploit the natural power structure of an older man and a younger woman.
Fine.
So not physical violence. It's not what you think of when you think of it's that kind of it's not the like a an irreversible rape.
Yes,
it's sycophantic behavior.
Yes,
yes,
it is still rape, but yes, it is it's.
It feels less in line with. I know about kids. I have not seen kids.
Okay. Yeah, it's just so like that girl struck me as like one of the kids from Kids, and that movie is like nothing but people making poor choices all the time. And so honestly, for that, I didn't really have a lot of trouble with that scene. And I think part of it's just because, you know, now I'm honestly not sure. It just like it, obviously I was skeezed out by it. Like it was gross.
Yes, sure.
Like I didn't. First of all, why would she be into him?
I guess
he's Robert Pattinson. So, and like I said,
he looks even worse with that blonde hair. Holy shit! I was just looking at him. I was like, oh man,
that bleach.
Oh, jeez.
It's so weird because he terrible gives her, right, he gives her every reason to fucking just not deal with him, and she sticks around. Like it's so weird because he walks into the room and she's like, she's like, what the fuck are you like? What's up with your hair? And he's like, oh, I found some like hair dye and I put it in. I guess I'm just a weirdo. And I was like, mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. Go to your room and don't leave until daylight.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. I think. Go ahead.
No, I'm sorry, but go ahead.
No, I wasn't going to say anything.
I'm going to make a call. Michael, go ahead.
I think why I feel extra iffy about that sexual assault, or however we want to refer to it, is the camera work in that. Is a little bit, it certainly doesn't affirm it, but it's less ambiguous than the rest of the film. I would say that, you know, like the Safdies kind of have this interesting combination of something that feels very detached, which makes a lot of things very realistic, but they also know when to amp things up. And that is a scene where it is amped up, like the, you know, the OPN soundtrack kind of like, it doesn't peak in that moment, but it's abrasive in a way that feels not triumphant, but there is something less claustrophobic in that moment. Like there is, in terms of the optics of that scene, I think both the camera work and the soundtrack make me feel a little bit more complicated than other scenes of gratuitousness, which seem to fit into like larger ideas of how privilege can get you through anything.
Well,
I think that's why I'm hesitating a tiny bit.
I think that you can't have the same score for that scene that you have for like him breaking his brother out of the hospital, because it just wouldn't fit. It would feel almost comical. Like I think that by slowing down in that moment, you get the opportunity to understand how gross the situation is.
Sure.
Rather than kind of like, you know, the synth pumping, like, oh my god, what's happening? Oh, he's getting out of the hospital. Is he going to make it? This time you're just like, oh, please, dear god, don't do this. And And then that quietude also helps to make the freneticism of what follows, which is Ray waking up and realizing he's not in the hospital anymore, and the weird fight that they have even more. I mean, of everything that happened, I had the most trouble with what they did to Barkhad Abdi.
I mean,
that, truly, that is the most fucked up thing you can do to a person. And I took some small comfort in the realization that at some point, someone's going to figure out what the fuck is going on. Like,
but the way that whole scene plays out is unbelievable.
And clearly by the end of that film, that's kind of where everything kind of comes to head, because that's why the police like surround that place, because they realize, holy shit, we got the wrong guy. Well, Wait, where does he live?
I think it's probably just that like someone in that apartment building like heard all this shouting and the dog barking and then the guy getting attacked in the hall. But I feel like they're gonna say, you know, oh my god, like we found this guy in this apartment. And this guy is the guy that we arrested last night who works here. And oh, fuck. Like, it's
maybe crazy. Yeah. Because the amount of cops that kind of show up for that sequence is definitely more than you would expect, right? If it was just like a call for like, hey, there's like this crazy ass dog that's loose in the apartment hallway and it just attacked somebody and they had a fight. Yeah. I think we need somebody. Yeah, there was like four or five cop cars that showed up at that place. So
that's a good point.
But then again, yeah. I've seen like three cop cars on a single pullover. So it's hard to know. Yeah. Cops don't respond with reasonable force at any time. but yeah, it would be the best if they were already on their way. Mm-hmm. And then they just got another call. But yeah, I think... I think that the Barkhad Abdi seed was a lot worse. And I think that more so than the near statutory rape, the way that he just kind of like sells her down the river and mm-hmm. lets her be taken in by the cops is like God. Even more dark than that.
Yeah.
Because like you see like the sense of betrayal and loss on her face.
Mm-hmm.
This fucking asshole, like just being like no, it wasn't a girl, it's whatever. And then they're like, okay, well, we're taking her in the car, and he's like, okay, sure.
She's pretty excellent in that second act.
She's great throughout her entire time in the movie. She makes this young woman's like actions, which are wholly like ill-advised, at least completely believable from like a character standpoint.
Well, I like that she knew exactly his idea as soon as she was, or he was like, oh, so your ex-boyfriend does drugs, huh? Or sells drugs, huh? Like does he live around here? What's his address? And she's like, no, I'm not giving you his address so you can go stick him up. Like, that's not what's gonna happen right now, you know. So she was smart enough to kind of have that wherewithal to be like, yeah, this guy might be into me, but like I'm not gonna give him my ex-boyfriend's like, you know, location. That seems like a dumb idea. So I don't know. This movie's just so fucking I still can't get over the fact that like what balls on these two directors to literally write in that he gets the wrong person out of the hospital and is just like constantly trying to like figure out how he's going to go back into that hospital to go get his brother. And you're just like, that is a terrible idea. Like,
the craziest part is that he never comes close to getting his brother out of prison. He is $10,000 away, and then he picks up a whole wrong person, and then it only gets worse from there. Like, it's not even like he's like, you know, I had my brother in the chair, but I just couldn't get him down the elevator. It's like, no, you never even found him.
Yeah.
He's acting like he was 95% there, when at best he was like vaguely in the same building.
Yes. Absolutely.
But he's just got that. He's got that. That sense of it. He's like, no, I was fine. I was smart. I asked that guy while the cops were there, and I went to the, You know, he
went to that exact floor.
He does, like, all the stuff that Jason Bourne would do if the bullet that shot Jason Bourne in the head had caused more damage. Like, he knows just enough to get close enough to fail spectacularly.
Yeah.
And it's, like, it's beautiful and compelling to watch.
And one of the things, you know, there's so many little, like, small wrinkles to this film that I really enjoy. And one of them in particular is the bail bondsman. And I love that he basically took all the money and he said, cool, that's a shit ton of cash. It was like $16,000 or something like that. And he was like, cool, that's a shit ton of cash. And, you know, Connie's like, hey, so can I get my brother out? And he's like, no, I can't do anything with this money, you dumbass. Like, it's got red dye all over it. Like, what do you think anybody that sees that is going to think? They're going to think, wow, this money's all fucked up and it's going to come back to me. And so instead of, like, giving it back to Connie, he's like, nah, I'm just going to hold on to it. I might do something with it at some point. Maybe I wash it. Maybe the dye comes out. Maybe it fades away after a certain amount of time. I'm just gonna keep it in my thing, and you're not gonna be able to do shit about it, because what are you gonna do? Hey, I gave this guy a bunch of money that had dye all over it. Now I can't get it back. Like, he's got no out. So he just handed over all that money, and the bail bondsman's like, no, I'm keeping that. Like,
that bail bondsman and his like Girl Friday, and like that whole scene when he's in there with
I love that so much.
That's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah. That,
like,
was just,
oh man,
that whole scene, I was like freaking out. I was like having an anxiety attack, because like she is screaming at her mother.
Yeah.
And the guy is literally on two phones, and fucking Connie is just like, oh my god, like, guys, can everybody, like, what's happening? Calm down. We don't even know where my brother is. And god, Jennifer Jason Leigh in this movie is the worst. Like, ugh. I hate her in this movie. I think, like, it's just, I have known people like her, like 40 years old, but like living at home with their parents, mm-hmm. and like still acting like a teenager.
Yeah. Like, and she's clearly like in love with Connie to the point of like over infatuation, because like he even calls her on it. He's like, hold on, I just told you all this shit about like what happened to my brother. And you're like
going to Costa Rica.
Yeah. And you're just like, what? And so in a way, it's kind of, he's using her. Yes. But at that point, you're like, nah, fuck it. Like, go for it, dude. Like, you're just like, yeah, she's a real piece of shit. Like,
I love how she's Googling swim up bars.
Oh, my God.
What? One more thing, too, about that bail bond scene. I'm thinking about it now. Like, that is really just like an expertly shot, and especially when it comes to the audio, like you're already talking about in the background how she's just escalating, but then you have this fantastic just conversation back and forth between Pattinson, the bail bondsman, the person he's talking to on the phone, trying to get the judge. Like, there's so many interesting turns that are happening there where, like, you know, Pattinson is slightly turning the screw, like getting slightly less polite. But then always kind of rearing back because he knows he has to be kind, but he knows he needs something. Like, that whole scene is so, like, it's just a single scene that shows how the Safdie brothers understand just, like, tension and energy of, like, conversation.
Yeah, what a nightmare of a sequence. Yeah, what a nightmare of a sequence to probably just shoot. I mean, can you imagine, like, how many angles, how many different times they probably had to redub that and recut it, and, you know, the editing there. Yeah, you're right, Michael. Like, I was able to track everything that was happening in that sequence, and there's – you know, like God bless him, Christopher Nolan, but sometimes I can't understand what a fucking character is saying in your movie, and I'm watching this movie and five people are talking all at once over each other, and I'm able to perfectly follow it. So, you know, it's like, wow, okay.
Yeah, take that, Christopher Nolan.
That's the power of sound editing and mixing.
Yeah.
I couldn't find it again, but someone on Twitter had said that I think that a lot of the players on the side in this movie are actually people, like,
yes,
like you were saying, Bill. And I think that the bail bondsman was one of them.
No, he's a professional actor.
What was that?
The bail bondsman, I thought, is a professional actor.
I don't know, because
I was just listening to the film comments conversation yesterday.
Eric the bail bondsman is played by Eric Paykert, and on IMDb, at least, his only credit is Good Time as Eric the bail bondsman.
Well, never mind. Get him in way more movies.
So
yeah, he's really good.
What I heard on Twitter, and again, I couldn't find it, so this may all be apocryphal, but it seems like the type of thing that could be true about this. So hopefully, I can find it and maybe post it somewhere. Is that they had an actual actor who was going to play the bail bondsman, and it just didn't feel right. So they got an actual bail bondsman so that they could get like the rhythms of it down. And they were talking about how, like, when he was on the phone getting information from the judge or about the judge and everything, at some point he, like, rolled his eyes and said, lovely, like, in terms of, like, the information he was getting. So he's like, oh, great, lovely. He went to the thing. And they were like, and that's just the kind of, like, true-to-life character shit that you can't get from an actor, because this guy has lived this conversation and this moment, like, 100 times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm also curious because I see here that Peter Verby plays Peter the psychiatrist.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm wondering if that's a similar thing where they got the same.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like I said,
Rachel Black is Rachel the public defender.
Heaven knows what is just filled with all these people literally coming off the streets like, oh, hey, that's an interesting person. Let's cast them in my movie. And, you know, so they almost like carve out characters specifically for these people. And in, I guess in this case, they literally carved out people for these characters. You know, they were just like, oh, hey, we have this character. Let's go find that person. And so that's what they kind of did. And, you know, to be honest with you, I think the 16-year-old black girl is actually one of those characters as well. I'm pretty sure. So,
yeah, it says introducing in the movie, I believe.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was introducing Talia Webster.
Yeah. So I think the Safdies are definitely interesting filmmakers to kind of keep an eye on, because they are going to continue to kind of do this shit where – and I mean, like I said, like I'm not even sure what's going on with some of those overhead shots, because they're also really sped up. And I thought that was kind of an interesting kind of take on it, because, you know, usually when you get like a helicopter shot like that, people tend to kind of like lavish it a little bit. And they're like, hey, we spent all this money on a helicopter shot, so let's, you know, not speed it up. But the Safdies were like, nah, let's fast forward through this shit. And so I'm not sure if that's just like drone footage. I couldn't tell a dip in quality.
I watched the end credits, and they did talk about having a helicopter operator. So,
wow.
Oh,
wow.
Yeah.
That I don't know if y'all have heard kind of like who is it? Louis talk about his like him making the show, Louis, and he mentioned like in getting a helicopter is not a cheap endeavor. And and so, you know, the fact that they got a helicopter to make this movie, I think maybe probably says something about just, you know, the fact that it has Robert Pattinson in it. But just the same, I just can't imagine a studio looking at this film and being like, oh, yeah, that movie's going to make a lot of money.
Robert Pattinson must be savvy as fuck, because he made himself the kind of actor. I'm not even going to say he's a bankable actor. But he is the type of actor who appears bankable because he was in mm-hmm. Twilight movies. And so
it's similar to like it's so interesting that the Twilight series, kind of one of the off and on kind of, you know, some critics actually like it. Some critics really rail against it. But specifically, like at least the first two movies in that series, I think the quality, it's one of those rare series where the quality has actually gone up as the movies gotten further on.
Sure.
But for that movie, as railed against as it is by so many different people, whether it's, you know, a lot of males that just simply are like, it's a dumb female, you know, driven kind of movie, or just kind of critical.
I've heard more feminists give shit to Twilight than men, honestly.
Yeah, because a lot of men probably never saw it and just avoided it outright. You know, when you start hearing things like sparkling vampires, I think a lot of guys are like, I'm out. I'm good.
See you later, Lisa Frank.
Yeah, I'm good. I'm out of this. I do not need a Snapchat filter on my vampires.
What I was going to say is that, like, he got himself to appear to be bankable, and now he can both work with interesting people,
sure,
and interesting mm-hmm. people want to work with him, because I guarantee you can get a couple extra $1 million out of saying we cast Robert Pattinson.
Oh, yeah. So,
like,
because they're just
maneuver.
Sure. And like I was saying, my overall point about that rant about Twilight was basically it's given us two of maybe my favorite actors to mm-hmm. come yeah. out of their generation. Like,
for sure.
I love anything that Kristen Stewart does. I will pretty much watch from this point forward. And same with Pattinson. Like, I'll literally seek it out. And so that's a crazy, crazy thing that film series that a lot of people have pretty much forgotten by now.
Now where is Taylor Lautner?
Jesus, I don't
is
know.
That right?
Selling
that guy.
Yeah,
I did.
Selling jeans somewhere. Who knows?
He's working on that. What was that movie he was in? The Abandoned
Abduction.
He's working on the Abduction sequel.
I think the other really cool thing. I mean. Bill, I totally agree with you. I adore Pattinson and Stewart, but I think partly what makes them so great, besides possibly having an amazing agent and just really good taste for scripts, but just the fact that they are willing to do a lot of things. Like, you know, however you felt about Personal Shopper or Clouds of Sils Maria or any of those, like, Stewart has to be, you know, put through the emotional ringer in both of those. She has to be placed in as not only the center of attention, but just at the, you know, she has to carry the movie. And Pattinson as well is put in these roles that are constantly, like, distorting his appeal. But also, like, there are a lot of actors who aren't willing to, you know, be a drug dealer, for instance, without mm-hmm. it being, you know, a biopic or, you know, a prestige, like, Oscar role.
Mm-hmm.
Like, their willingness to contort themselves for the, you know, for the screen and for what's necessary, I think is what also makes them very unique. And whether that came from the desperation and worry of, like, you know, flaring out after Twilight or whatever, like, or, you know, genuine interest, I think that's also what's made them kind of singular.
Yeah.
I want nothing more in this life than for Pattinson and Stewart to pull a revolutionary road. And, like, you know, because we had Kate and Leo, and then mm-hmm. years after Titanic, Revolutionary Road comes out, and it's like, oh, what if Kate and Leo or Jack and Rose had gotten married? And it's like, oh, their lives are terrible. They're totally unhappy. They're stuck in suburbia. And spoiler alert, she dies. So,
it's, I want a cat on a hot seat roof with those two.
Yeah. So now I want a Robert Pattinson, Kristen Stewart Revolutionary Road scenario where they do a movie where they're, like, just at each other's throats, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf style.
Mm.
Yeah. One of the things that I love, though, and I have to say this pretty much any time that that we do a Kristen Stewart or Robert Pattinson movie, is I always love whenever we
do
a review or I write a review and I get feedback from these people.
Yep.
Because I'm always like, I'm just so happy. Because, like, I wrote a review for The Rover for my personal site, and it was the most read review of that year for me.
Oh, yeah.
And I had, like, a bunch of people with Kristen Stewart avatars on Twitter, like, tweeting out, like, oh my god, The Rover was so good, I loved that movie. And I was like, who the fuck are you? This is amazing. And, like, whatever inroad you take, you know, whatever it takes to get people to see these movies. And that's another reason why I think that Stewart and Pattinson are, like, so bold and shrewd and intelligent is just like they are leveraging what they got from this series that has dubious value and turning it into this like empire of really great, amazing, interesting work that people are going to grow up seeing and hopefully adapting into a finer, refined cinematic palette. It's just, it's great to see. I love it.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yeah. And I'm sure Jordan can back us up here. Yeah. Anytime we do anything for like one of these RPAT or Case 2 films. Yep. I went there. It definitely gets a lot more hits than kind of you would expect, especially for a small budget film by the Safdie brothers. So
damn right. So hopefully, because this is an A24 film, it's released wide. Hopefully everyone who's interested in it has had a chance to go out and see it. If you were waiting for the end of the podcast to make up your mind.
Do you guys want to talk about the end at all? You already mentioned it.
The fact that Ray falls out a window?
No, the credits. And the opening.
Yeah, I was ready to wrap up, but yeah, we can talk about that.
Well, Bill had mentioned it, so I feel like he didn't get to say. I know he liked it, but he liked it less than us. So I don't want to make him feel like he's being stomped on here.
No, I don't. I think I'm trying to remember specifically my issues with kind of my main issues with the film in general is just and we've already kind of touched on it, is just like the piece of shit filth kind of like character work being done here. So I really, really, really like that final kind of bookend piece. I like the way that wraps up, and I really enjoy that because I think it shows just a little bit of hope if you get Nick away from Connie for a little while, and hopefully he kind of lightens up and hopefully he kind of opens up. I think the more we've talked through this film, the less issues I've kind of had with the film itself and more the character work. And I can't be like, oh, that's a real piece of shit character, so, you know, it's a terrible movie. No, that's the way the character was written, and so that's the way it was performed. And if it's having that effect on me, it means it's a good performance and it means it did its job. So just because I do not want to spend another goddamn minute with Connie doesn't mean that this is a bad movie. So yeah, that's what I'll say about that. I really like that game that she kind of plays at the end. I think that's such a smart, like, interesting icebreaker kind of a game. You know, it's probably a common thing, especially in scenarios like that, where you're dealing with kind of people that are kind of shut in and kind of aren't super open. You know, going around the room and saying your favorite color isn't going to quite do it, you know? Yeah. So, yeah, I think that sequence works really well. So.
Agreed. All right. So that's it for Good Time. It is out in theaters now. Definitely, definitely, definitely check it out. It is one hell of a good time. No, it's not. It's a stress nightmare. The likes of which you've never seen, but is really, really
that's not what the movie title means?
No.
Okay.
I would say it's a feel bad time.
it's a harrowing time.
It's a, you know,
it's a sweaty, messy time.
It's a neon soaked, sweat drenched cigarette. You're smelling waste of life.
This movie, what it makes me feel like is when I look at his hair and it's dyed that like bleach blonde, that's what that movie makes me feel.
It already kind of seems like it's got grease in it already. Like, how is your hair that dirty right after bleach? So that's it for today. If you enjoyed this episode and want to hear more from us, sponsor us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Give us your money. I'm just gonna
don't say it like that.
Give us your money.
Thanks, all fat fans.
Hand me the loot. fork it over. You will get access to our incredible Slack channel and daily, or not daily, weekly raffles and other cool stuff. So give us your money. Patreon.com/thephilipstageshow. You can also get a free 30-day trial of MUBI by going to MUBI.com/thephilipstage. And I think it's just film stage. We mess with that definite article too much. MUBI.com/filmstage. Currently, they are showing Mulholland Drive.
Ew.
The incredible get film on that. By David Lynch. And you should check it out. It's got Naomi Watts in it. Naomi Watts, who is
The Glass Castle.
She is also the source. I'm rewatching BoJack Horseman because the new season is coming out in like 2 weeks.
I can't
and
do it.
One of my favorite jokes in that show is just still, it's dumb. I'm not even going to say it. No, I'm going to say it. It's BoJack going, Naomi, what? Anyway.
BoJack's good show.
Good shit. So yeah, MUBI, MUBI.com/filmstage for your free 30-day trial. So that is that. Gentlemen, let's tell the fine people where you can be found at home between now and the next time we speak. Bill Graham.
You can find me definitely taking a shower after watching this damn movie on Twitter at CableBFG, and you can find me on the Slack channel probably ranting and raving about how many more people are starting to come out of the woodwork saying they like Logan Lucky. Woot!
Ooh. All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me sneaking into abandoned amusement parks at on Twitter at Snydell. And I've been still writing stuff on Letterboxd, and you can find me on Slack as well, where I try not to piss people off.
All right, you can find me pissing people off on Slack and on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan, my personal site, dearfilm.net, and, of course, thefilmstage.com. Tune in next week. We're going to talk about – we got some movies coming out that we're probably what are we talking about next week?
I have no idea.
All right, we'll figure it out. Follow us on Twitter to find out what we're talking about next week at Film Stage Show. So, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us, and tune in next time. Not a jacker in sight, and everything is all right. I got a beat from Kim, and she could do it all night. Called up the homies, and I'm asking y'all, which part are y'all playing basketball? Get me on the court, and I'm troubled. Last week, messed around and got a triple-double. Freaking